From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
I couldn't resist when I heard the title of a lecture being given near me by a visiting North Carolina State University zoologist. I had to know more. No, garden friends, the talk wasn't titled Woodchuck Proof Your Backyard or Rabbits Be Gone Permanently, which would have attracted me too, but for more obvious reasons. The lecture sounded far more dramatic. The return of predators to urban America. We've all read about it in the headlines, coyotes in the Bronx or in Chicago, for instance, more human encounters of the close kind with black bear. Sales of so-called trail cameras are up, and not just for use by hunters or scientists. Dr. Roland Kays is the North Carolina State University zoologist and expert in using new technologies to study free-ranging animals, including the ones that may very well live in your neighborhood and garden. He has a broad interest in ecology and conservation, especially of mammals. He's the author of Mammals of North America from Princeton University Press, and also leader of the project called eMammal, a citizen science animal counting collaboration with the Smithsonian. Roland directs the Biodiversity Lab in the Nature Research Center of North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences, and I invited him to the program today to talk about all that and more. Welcome, Dr. Roland Kays. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. And it's, I have to say, I'm loving the book, Mammals of North America, and your website and all the places it's been sending me to. All the, down all the rabbit holes it's been sending me.
Yeah. Well, and you know, from how you started the show there, maybe the return of predators will take care of your woodchuck and rabbit problem.
Oh, boy. I'm hoping. And the problem, of course, is that I've gone and created sort of a false situation by having 2 acres of big fence around me, so the biggest guys who live right outside the fence can't get in and take care of the smaller guys.
It could be, yeah.
Yeah, I've made a mess for myself. So I should say right up top that the predators lecture that I mentioned in the intro, I'll have all the details on my website with the transcript of this show, and it's at Cary Institute in Millbrook, New York, at 7 p.m. on Friday, July 10th. So as I said, I'll give all the details. I know from your sort of CV online and your website that you've done field work in many areas of the world. And by the way, I also found out that you ride a unicycle, which really made me smile. You're an unusual, you're a Renaissance man, yeah?
Well, if unicycling and animals make you a Renaissance man, then that's me.
Yeah. So, how did things closer to home get to be the focus? Like how, rather than like kinkajous and ocelots, you've had your eye on raccoons and coyotes and such around, I guess it started around Raleigh-Durham, yes, and now it's moving to other domestic settings?
Well, I mean, I think the animals close to home were where it all started, and
okay. So
they've never gone away. I mean, that's what got me interested in science and interested in ecology and conservation right from the beginning.
Uh-huh.
Was growing up in Michigan and running around the woods in my backyard, and then you know the stream down the street, and just getting out there with the Boy Scouts and hiking and enjoying nature. And so, you know, I think that's where it's always started. It's never really gone away. I've had the fortune to go check out other people's backyards in other parts of the country. I mean, not literally, but, you know, other ecosystems, other animals. But I've always had interest in local stuff as well. And so, I worked at the New York State Museum for 11 years in Albany and did a lot of work on fishers and coyotes and other animals that were right in suburban Albany, and now I'm down in Raleigh, North Carolina, and continuing that work there.
So we read a lot about habitat loss and other profound human influences that are forcing animal species either out of areas where they traditionally lived or even toward extinction. And some of your recent work and your upcoming talk at Cary Institute looks at the species who are trying to survive by responding to those same human impacts and evolving. So can we talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, habitat loss has been a huge problem all around the world for a long time, but and continues today in large parts of the world. But in a lot of eastern United States, a lot of the habitat came back. And really, you know, the low point for wildlife was about 100 years ago when there were so few forests left, and there was no management of the hunting or fur trapping. And so there was hardly any forest, and people were setting traps and shooting everything all year round without any restrictions. And we've come a long way, and now, you know, the hunting and the trapping is well managed. We have abundant game populations, and the forest has come back all over the place. Mm-hmm. So there's, you know, there's way more habitat now than there was 100 years ago. And the animals are returning, and you know, evolution, the change of animals, includes changes of their behavior. And I think what we're seeing is they're starting to move more and more into urban areas, and certainly suburban areas, and into the outskirts of town, and kind of reclaiming some of their old territory, but in different ways, because we're here now. And so they're slotting in the spaces in between all the human settlement.
So I read in a recent paper you wrote with a colleague, the sentence, backyard animals represent one of the closest and most permanent wildlife-human interactions. And maybe that seems obvious, but not really. But how do those interactions go? Like, what are some of the ranges, you know, both for the animals and for the humans? I mean, I also read in that paper and other work you've done about everything from, you know, the attraction of chicken coops to the factors of dogs versus, you know, the family pet dog who's fenced versus unfenced, and a new paper you just did about cats and coyotes. So kind of let's talk about some of anecdotally and beyond those interactions.
Yeah, sure. Well, I think, you know, maybe the most interesting, the most amazing part is kind of a little bit more subtle, which is how few interactions there actually are. I mean, so many of these animals are out at night when we are sleeping. And
yes.
So, you know, there's so many animals out there that we don't even know are sneaking around and are, you know, using the woods near our houses and coming into our backyards at night that we just never see. And so there's a lot of that. But certainly, you know, there are interactions as well, and they range, you know, most of them, I think, are quite positive. People like seeing the birds in their yard. They like, you know, for the most part, seeing the animals. They just don't like when they, you know, the negative side, certainly for gardeners, comes when the herbivores, you know, eat all the plants that they're trying to take care of. And that is certainly, you know, one of the negative sides. You know, when that herbivore happens to be a giant bear, then it can start to be quite dangerous. And you know, it does go up to the very extreme in some cases of you know, carnivores actually attacking people. Usually when that happens, it's because an animal has rabies. It's kind of a little bit of a freak occurrence, and you know, not very predictable and not very common. But you know, there is potential for healthy animals to attack, especially smaller people, you know, kids,
right,
mostly. And again, that's very rare, but, you know, just looking at the total range of possibilities, it goes from being totally charmed by the beautiful buck walking through your backyard to being terrified at some carnivore that's maybe a threat to you and your kids. And indeed, you know, that's the whole range of experiences with nature anywhere in the world, and now they're starting to extend themselves into our yards.
So what about, like, how is it different when there are backyard chickens, for instance, or, again, a fenced or an unfenced dog? You know, some of these specific trappings of our human, you know, living in these areas and the animals who explore them. I mean, it kind of depends what they encounter, and some of the things might be attractive and some repellent to the predator or the various animals, the various mammals, yeah?
Yeah, and these are, you know, these are the types of questions that we're still learning the answers to, you know, it's kind of a new area of research to see, well, you know, why are there some animals in some places and not in other places, and what are the consequences of that? And we've done some work, for example, this project you mentioned recently with the chicken coops, where we were interested if chicken coops attract a different type of animal to someone's backyard than yards that don't have chicken coops. So we worked with volunteers in the Raleigh area that did or did not have chicken coops, and they ran camera traps in their backyard, you know, near the chicken coop, and or in the backyard of someone who didn't have a chicken coop, or sometimes out in the woods sort of nearby but not actually in a backyard. And then these motion-sensitive cameras take a picture whenever a warm-blooded animal walks in front. So they don't sample turtles very well or snakes, but they get, you know, mammals sort of chipmunk size and up, and any bird that's walking on the ground in front. And they take photographs of the animals, and then volunteers send the data to us, and the volunteers identify the animals, and then we sort of double check it. So we have a really good, we love it from a scientist point of view because we can verify the data. You know, it's not somebody telling me maybe they think they saw a mountain lion in their backyard, but it's actually a photograph that I can verify and say, oh yeah, you know, this is a red fox or this is a gray fox, which sometimes people mix up. But if we have a photograph, we can definitely tell.
You mean all the wolf sightings that you hear about?
Yeah, you know, I there's no ending of the mountain lion tales for sure,
yes.
And the you know the mm-hmm. wolves sometimes
yes.
as well. Mountain
yes,
lions
yes.
seem to be more on the line of Sasquatch, but that's another
yes.
another podcast.
Yes,
I think.
Yes, yes, yes.
So what we found with the chicken coops was a little bit surprising because there's sort of this story, you know, of the fox and the hen and the fox raiding the chicken coop. And in Raleigh, we have a lot of gray foxes, not as many red foxes.
Yes, but, I do too. I love it. It's one of my favorite animals. Yeah.
So there was no effect of chicken coops on the likelihood of a gray fox being in your backyard. Basically, gray foxes were quite common in yards that had chicken coops or yards that didn't have chicken coops.
Uh-huh.
And we didn't get any record of the gray foxes showing any real interest in the chicken coops, and these were all, you know, at night they're kept inside and they're locked up, and we didn't see any conflict there. Raccoons, on the other hand, were a problem for the chicken coops.
Yes.
They were more common in yards that had chicken coops, and we got them trying to break in, climbing over the top, stealing eggs, and so it seems like in the Raleigh area. Raccoons are the ones you need to keep out of your chicken coop. You need to raccoon-proof your chicken coop, which is tricky because they're very good climbers.
They are indeed.
They're not as good of a diggers as some other species, so you maybe don't have to worry quite as much about that. But they're crafty. They know how to get into garbage cans. They know they'll find a weakness in your chicken coop if they can and cause some trouble.
Yeah.
So. That was interesting. The other interesting thing with regard to the foxes was comparing backyards to, you know, small urban woodlots. The foxes actually were more common in the backyards. So backyards were actually, in some ways, their preferred habitat.
Oh, interesting. I wonder if with mown areas they're able to find small, you know, like rodents running around easier or who knows what it is. But that's interesting. You know, why they would be there more than out in the woods, so to speak.
Yeah, I don't know. Food's likely an option.
Yeah.
Gray foxes eat a bit more fruit than other foxes, so it could be that some people had fruit trees or maybe they were, you know, sniffing a few bird seeds. But I think we still have a lot to learn about urban gray fox ecology and behavior.
And they can climb, yes?
Yeah, they are.
Fascinating.
They are pretty much, I think, about the only canid, the only dog, you know, sort of family member that climbs trees regularly, and that's thought to help them get at the fruit that they're known to eat, but also it probably helps them escape from coyotes. Coyotes are known to sort of persecute smaller predators, chase them, kill them, you know, kill their babies, all that kind of stuff, and the gray foxes seem to do better with coyotes, probably because they can scamper up trees if they get in trouble.
So you talked about camera traps. You mentioned camera traps, and then you also talked about people sending in data from their camera traps. Now, is this all part of eMammal, or is this was that a separate project?
Yes. Yeah. This is part of eMammal. The chicken coop was kind of one of our first projects with the eMammal project.
Okay.
And so eMammal is a citizen science camera trapping project. So we have volunteers run cameras. They upload the data to us, and again, they identify stuff, and then we double check them, and then mm-hmm. we put them in a database and use it for all sorts of different questions.
And so besides the eMammal, and I'll give all the links and everything so everybody can find out, and you're expanding it beyond Raleigh-Durham, aren't you now, to other sites in the country?
Yeah, we are. We have a bunch of cameras ourselves that we can loan out to folks, and that's done mostly in the Raleigh-Durham area. We're looking,
right.
This question of how far carnivores are moving into urban areas mm-hmm. is what we're trying to address in the Raleigh area. But if you have your own camera, you can sign up and participate. And we're working on a big revamp of our website this summer so that it'll be a little bit easier in the future to actually see and compare what you found with what other people around the world are finding.
Let's talk a little bit more about the night shift, you know, the kind of who's out there and what's going on. It is, I mean, whether you're, and some of my listeners around the country are urban and some are suburban, I'm rural. I mean, some animals overlap and some are distinct to some habitats. But the thing that kind of interests me the most is how, and this gets back to, you know, them living adjacent to us or with us, so to speak, this issue of habituation and how they seem, certain animal species seem to be able to observe and then change behavior to sort of live with us or work around us, or I don't know how you even would explain it. But habituation fascinates me. For instance, with bear, it's one of the things that we're warned as a rural dweller, where bear come into the yard all the time. You know, I'm warned what not to do to encourage them to even be more interested in living adjacent to me or with me. So what about habituation?
Yeah, so habituation is animals, you know, basically realizing that humans are not a threat. And
right.
Animals, predation is, you know, is the number one thing that animals are worried about, because you mess up avoiding a predator once and you're dead. And so, you know, they're very sensitive to that. But it's also sort of the kind of thing that can be fine-tuned over time, where they can realize that, you know, if because avoiding predators is costly. You know, if you're always looking around and you're always hiding, then you're not getting food. And so there's this balance between
right.
avoiding predators and getting food. And if a predator is, you know, if something is not actually a risk, then if you start to ignore it as a risk and start to just you know, feed, then you can feed more, you can have more babies, you know, you can be more successful. And so this habituation is basically them realizing, you know, animals realizing that humans are not a threat to them, and then so ignoring them and letting, you know, humans, you know, whereas if they see humans as a threat, they'll, as soon as they see you, they'll run away, or they'll hear you or smell you coming and run away, and you'll never even see them. And, you know, so from our side, what habituation means is we see the animals more often, and we're able to get closer to them without them running away. And, you know, you can just kind of tell that an animal's not on alert sometimes
right.
when they see you. They just, you know, they're ignoring you, and you can tell. Whereas, you know, if they're really concerned about you, they will pay a lot of attention. And you know, even if they don't run away, they'll be keeping a very close eye on you.
All species this can happen with habituation, or is it more common with, say, bear or coyotes? I don't know. Can all mammals become habituated?
Yeah, I think so.
To some degree?
I think we tend to see it more in the herbivores, right? The deer,
yes.
You know, the squirrels, for goodness sakes. And these, you know, these herbivores, those are the prey. Those, I mean, they're prey of everything, and so they're the ones that are paying the most attention to predators. And one of the concepts that we've started, we as a sort of the scientists have started finding to be interesting and starting to explore and see how important it is how species can habituate and basically use one species as a shield against another. And so in this case, I'm talking about them using humans as a shield against larger predators.
Oh,
and
interesting.
So other predators like coyotes are usually, you know, pretty leery of people. And it seems like the herbivores, the deer and the rabbits and the squirrels, habituate to people because they realize, well, you know, these people are a lot less of a threat to me than those coyotes out there in the woods are. And so, you know, I can come in and, you know, maybe I get chased by a dog every once in a while, or, you know, have to hide from a person every once in a while. But that's a lot better than being out there in the woods where the coyotes are really, you know, a threat to me and my children. Of course, I'm anthropomorphizing the brain of a herbivore here, but, you know, that's basically the process that we think is going on, is that that evolution is selecting for these animals that fear humans less, and so move in a lot closer to humans and to escape their main predators. And there's some reasons to think that this might happen, you know, this habituation would happen faster in the prey than the predators, but, you know, starting to wonder how long before these predators start catching on that, you know, we're not really a threat to them either, and start moving more and more into the urban area. And that might be what we're starting to see, for example, with the, you know, the increasing sightings of coyotes around New York in the last year or two.
Right. So we have maybe 3-4 minutes left, and I just want to kind of go through a few mammals, a few animals. By the way, in the Mammals of North America book from Princeton University Press, I loved going through the maps and seeing, have I sort of, quote, met everyone in my neighborhood,
oh, right.
you know? That
right.
was great. And you say that there's an app as well for that, yes?
Yeah, you should check out the app. It's even better than the book because it has what we call GPS-assisted identification, which means you can basically, the phone will tell the app where you are, and then it'll show you only the species that overlap with your location to limit, so you're not, you know, if you find a mole in your backyard or something, you're not trying to rule out moles from Alaska or
yes.
or California when you're looking at, you're just looking at the candidates that are actually available. The other thing is the app has sounds of about 150 mammals, which are really fun to listen to.
Who knew that? I didn't know, and I'm surprised that I didn't know because I thought I knew all the mammals around me. Lemming. A lemming.
The northern bog lemming, yes.
Yeah.
That's the southernmost lemming. It's really hard to see. It was my nemesis mammal for a long time.
So I don't feel so bad. Okay.
I had tried to find it for a long time and running small traps in various projects and never got one. And we finally got one in the Smoky Mountains last year with my mammalogy class.
So your life is...
They're kind of like voles, but a little bit kind of like what we call... prairie voles or
interesting
prairie mice.
Because
yeah.
I mean, I'm even at the point where I've met enough of these creatures that I, you know, I can tell my southern red-backed voles from my other voles, my meadow
oh,
voles,
nice.
And
yeah.
all that kind of thing. And you know, I know the difference. But boy, I didn't know there was a bog lemming.
So there's some idea that the bog lemmings might use the really less productive grasslands
uh-huh.
where other species fall out and they're able to compete.
Huh. Squirrels unhinge people, or delight people, or both. And I always wonder about, you know, the different colorations and so forth. Where I am farther, you know, in sort of the middle of New York State, we have a lot of black ones as well as the gray ones among the gray squirrel species. Are squirrels something that a lot of people ask you about?
Yeah, squirrels. And the coloration, you know, always fascinates people. Often they think they're different species, and actually, you know, it's just color morphs, like you said. There's some studies suggesting that these black squirrels do best in northern cities, where the blackness gives them a little bit more warmth in the sun in the winter.
Oh.
And but the lack of predators in the cities lets them survive despite not being very well camouflaged.
Huh. So... On this week, on Friday, you're going to be lecturing at Cary Institute in Millbrook, New York. I'm very excited about that, and I'm going to try to get myself out of my garden and down to come see you.
Great.
And that's at 7 p.m. at Cary. And I'm going to, of course, give people all the links to eMammal, also to the Mammals of North America, that you're co-author of, Dr. Roland Kays, with Don Wilson, yes?
Yep.
And the app, and as I said, all the other good stuff, and also to your website, which has many, as I said at the beginning, sort of adventures down the ha-ha rabbit hole, because good videos and all kinds of things to watch. I'm so glad to finally speak to you, and thank you very much.
Great. Yeah, thanks for having me on your show.
Okay. And it's nice to speak to all of you, of course, as we do every week. Don't miss an episode. You can get the podcast free on iTunes or Stitcher. And you can find me anytime at facebook.com/awaytogarden or awaytogarden.com. Happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.